G'day, g'day. Welcome to episode 100 of the Sports Medicine Project. Thank you very much for joining us. Boy and girls, do we have a big episode coming for you today. Two huge guests, return guests of the show. They've been around since the beginning. They were there at the creation of the Sports Medicine Project. The week they got COVID, they come up with this idea of having a podcast. I have my very knowledgeable co-host, Kelly Kortik.
And I have my knowledgeable co-host, my favourite podiatrist, some may say.
Whoa, big call.
Blake Withers. Mm. Podiatrist, clinical educator, lecturer, presenter, influencer. He's here.
Yeah, in the house. I have done some influencing, not for good educational content, but certainly for shoes. Someone messaged me through the podcast and actually asked me about a pair of shoes that I posted, and I'm pretty certain they did buy them. So that is one person influence. So I guess I do fit the
influencer role.
Yeah,
I reckon.
Yeah, very good. So episode 100.
I'm keen to talk about some stuff today. Yeah. I've been inspired over the last week of my learnings, and
I'll give you one better. I've been inspired the last 2 years we've been doing this podcast for.
Yeah, we have learned a lot. Hey, four days worth apparently.
Yeah, so we've done. If we say an hour on average, and who are we kidding? We have definitely done more than an hour per podcast. I mean, when we reach out to the guests. You know, we call it the knowledge hour on the booking page, and we say that it's going to be an hour, but it usually never is an hour. The time I stuff up the questions or the intro, or I ask a question and it turns into a 20-minute story before the actual question comes, so it ends up being like an hour and a half. But let's say an average per hour per episode, 100 hours divided by 24, it's about 4.1 days straight.
Nice.
That's a lot of time sitting in front of this mic speaking to people about feet and pain and menstrual cycles and morning erections and footwear. Crazy. They're the stuff that I remember that should come to mind.
They're the things that spring to mind.
Yeah.
What about bones and tendons?
Yeah, bones and tendons. Things? Yeah, they're as important as erections, I guess. But no, they are pretty cool. But to think that we have been able to connect with some of these people. And if you're listening to this and you've been here from the start or from the middle or you've only just come on, we can't thank you enough. I mean, it's been slowly progressing, and I think the people that have been listening and the information and the feedback that we get, it motivates us every time to want to get another guest on or for us to learn more and want to bring you this education. And it's free. Like, having this healthcare or this access to healthcare information shouldn't cost. Like, it's awesome that we can do that.
And it's just so great to generate such stimulating conversation with people.
Like, oh, I'm so stimulated.
I think about the conversations that I've had with people, say, on Instagram or social media platforms, that I would not know you if this podcast didn't exist. Like, I just don't think we would have had that opportunity to connect with people and have the conversations that we do and grow as clinicians as we have, which is just so great. So thank you for all of that.
Yeah. I was talking to Bo Chill from Sydney.
That's the person I had in my head.
Yeah. So, go and check out his... He's got Doso Instagram page, Bo the Physio and Stress Fracture Physio. And he was telling me that one of the motivations for him wanting to learn more about bones was when he listened to the podcast with Dr. Rich Willey. And that was a while ago. And he creates lots of good content. He shares
now
lots of research.
He's a stress fracture man.
Yeah. And to think that, albeit a small role, to play some role in that, I mean, it's just awesome. And he's just an awesome bloke as well. I mean, funnily enough, a couple of weeks ago, him and I were just chatting as we do about bone stress injuries. And I was like, oh, what are you doing tonight? This is about 9:30. He goes, oh, not much. I was like, oh, you want to just jump on Zoom and chat for an hour? And we did chat for about an hour to an hour and a half, just going back and forth, talking about bone stress injuries and MRIs. And
recorded it as an episode.
Yeah, I was thinking that. We were talking some awesome stuff. And I'm like, hey, what do you think of this idea? And I was drawing on the whiteboard in the background of my room. And yeah, to be able to do that is awesome. And putting your ideas out to have them critiqued is awesome, because you know the people that are critiquing them are doing it in the way in which is only going to make everyone feel better and grow better. Mm-hmm. So you can have these awesome conversations and basically be wrong and not feel bad about it because you've learnt from it. And I think having that space is awesome.
Yeah, I agree.
Only problem is, after that bloody episode that I... Oh, not episode we did with Bo, but when I was looking on the Zoom, I was in this position, what would you call it, forward neck lean, and I woke up... That was when I woke up with the wry neck.
That's how it started. And the neck was gone. And then this last 2 weeks, you've just I've been down bad.
Yeah, I've been real stiff.
Been having to do...
Bit of manual therapy.
PAs and all this
stuff.
I've been
fixing my posture and everything.
I'm
going to
book him in. I'm going to book Blake in with one of the physios at the clinic, I think. I think he needs some real treatment.
Yeah, we spoke about that. I just don't think I would be a good patient. I think that I would go and I would just ask lots of questions and then I don't know if I would come back. Yeah, I think I would do something, but I would want the fix. I'm like, just fix it, man. Fix the facet. Because in the lower limb, it's different to the upper limb. Lower limb's a bit easier.
You just like taking
the
medication, hey?
Yeah.
Just go straight to the end.
Okay, bang. Just cortisone me now. PRP in the back. But I would like to get a scan just to see what it looks like. Just to see how degenerated it is.
See how many discs are bulging.
Oh, I reckon if I saw that, saw that there was a bit of degeneration, I'd go, get me in, book me in now.
Nah,
I'll be signing up for private
health.
Yeah,
I mean, you've got a pretty cooked knee and you've seen the MRI for that and that doesn't seem to faze you too much. So
yeah.
I think it would bother you too much.
Yeah, I think I'd be all right. If I saw something wrong, as long as someone got up a whiteboard and just drew the peripheral nerve and told me about hypersensitization, I'd be sweet.
Hypersensitization.
I've been reading too many fucking research papers about pain lately. Peripheral sensitization was the thing I'm thinking about. But anyway.
I've got a question for you.
Yeah.
So, on Friday, I attended the Women in Sports Congress, which was awesome. And we're going to talk about that on International Women's Day. Yep. Which we're going to talk about in a second. I'm just going to rehash a few of my highlights from the day.
Mm.
But I wanted to ask you a question. It's something that I was thinking about throughout the Congress, and I had a few conversations with some of the women there. Because the group of people that were there was probably 85 to 90% women.
Mm.
And we were sort of saying, look, a lot of what probably needs to happen is there probably needs to be more men in this room to try and share the love around a little bit.
Mm.
And I personally find that I ebb and flow between feeling like I'm a bit of like a raging feminist when I try and have conversations or educate people on women's problems and the, you know, the gaps in research and things like that. But I also think it needs to be discussed. And I want to know from your point of view, sorry, I've just kind of thrown you in the deep end here.
Right.
But I want to know from your point of view, like what do you think would be the preferred way to learn about women's health and the gaps in research and where, you know, things need to go to support women's sport? That doesn't make you feel like you've got like a wall up because it makes me feel like I'm a raging feminist, or do you not care about that? Like, what are your thoughts? Because I know that it definitely affects a lot of men. Like, I think a lot of men look at women and they're just like, oh fuck, like here we go again.
Yeah. I guess that's our big announcement. We're not talking about healthcare anymore. We're going straight into politics. We're going to talk politics. We're going to talk, should there be a social welfare, that kind of stuff. Should there be women's rights? That's what we're going to start talking about. No, I I don't feel like I have a wall up with any of that stuff. I find it really interesting.
Mm.
But I completely understand that people don't find it interesting. I think it's great that there's been lots of funding and lots of energy put into, I guess, generating any kind of maybe media or... I guess you could say media around women's sport and women's research. I think a lot of these things will just take time for it to grow. Like I know a really interesting podcast that I like to listen to is Sam Harris's Making Sense podcast. And someone did analysis on that. It's a really popular podcast. Someone did an analysis on, I think he's maybe got 200 episodes and they looked at how many of those, and he interviews people like, you know, Elon Musk and really smart intellectual people. And I think there was only maybe 6.9% of all the guests on there had been female or something like that. So, but he'd started that a long time ago. And I think potentially in those positions, there are more men because that's been the history. And I think it is changing. I'm not able to comment on how that should change and if it's changing quick enough because I just don't know. But for me personally, just for me, I think it's awesome. And I love to learn about women's bodies and health and how it affects my clinical practice. And anytime any female or woman is doing anything, I don't know. I don't really look at it as if it's male or a female. I mean, you might look at it different. Like, if you were to see a female versus a male doing their PhD, I would just look at them the same. I don't really even... Gender doesn't even cross my mind.
Mm.
But potentially, you might see the female doing that and, I don't know, be more excited. I don't know.
What do you think the best way is to approach educating males about it, though? Like, even let's step out of the healthcare space and talk about, like, even just educating people like our dads, say, or, you know, like, generations that are maybe a little bit older and they don't have a great knowledge in the health space. Like, I could so picture your dad being, like make comments about like the women's sport and things like that.
Just a throwaway comment. Just like, it's good. It's good, but it's just, not as good. They don't need it as hard.
Like, what do you think? I'm just interested.
I don't know, but I feel like right now I'm walking in the desert on a minefield and someone has like a gun to my head playing Russian roulette because I'm trying to think of the words as politically correct as possible.
Though, right?
No, but like, I feel
it's challenging, and that's why I'm kind of putting you in this spot, because I find this stuff really interesting. And everyone that I was at the Congress with, we were talking about this, you know, it's really hard to get these messages across and try and almost get buy-in from the male population.
What messages are you trying? Like, are you trying to get are you talking about the conclusions from research, or are you trying to get females included in research?
That, and trying to maybe get the message across that, like, women, like girls even, youth development needs to be at a volume that's as, like, that's equal to the men, and even from a younger, like, age group, and that, like, one of the things I'm going to talk about, well, I'll talk about it now, so...
On that topic, I just wanted to pull you up on that. One thing I would add to it is those things just take time. Like, you can't have... Let's talk about youth development. I mean, you just can't have, from a point of view of resources and energy and finance, you can't just create, you know, 20 youth female teams to have them move from youth to high level. It just takes a lot of time. So I think there's financial considerations, of course, and there's also considerations of people wanting to be involved. And there is no doubt there has been more males involved in the sport, and I guess a lot of the attention has been on male sport for a long time because it just hasn't been female sport. Like, I mean, look at the WNRL. That's only been around for a short period of time, but it's growing, and that can only move in stages. I don't know if it can move that much quicker, but it can certainly move a lot slower. And it's been moving pretty well.
I do agree with you, but someone's got to try and drive that change. I think that comes from women probably having more of a voice to make these problems more known to the general population. And I think the way to approach that is challenging for a lot of women because, I don't know, feeling a bit imposter syndrome-y, and maybe other women don't, but I just feel as though that a lot of the responses from men, like, even I talk to my dad about some of this stuff, like, he'll make comments and I'll pull him up on it, and it's not well reciprocated. So I don't know, just something that I've been thinking about, but we can move on.
Yeah.
We've been talking about this for a bit.
Yeah. Well, let's hit me with some of the considerations and we'll go conference, point, chat. And then I've got some stuff to talk about. We've got some case study questions that people have sent through on the Instagram, which happens all the time. And every time someone sends one through, I think to myself, before I send back this 10-minute voice message or even talk to them on the phone, we can speak about it, and then I can also send that because then I can have it in a longer format and it makes it a lot more sense. So we'll go point for point. What do you reckon? Sounds good?
Yeah. So this first one, I'm going to hit you with two to start with because the first one's just a really... Oh, maybe it won't be super quick. But so did you know you can measure muscle fiber type using MRI? Yeah. So you can measure if it's a type 1 or a type 2 fiber, or if there's crossover, or what the percentage is of type 1 versus type 2 fibers.
In a general MRI.
In a general MRI.
Do they have to do any dye or anything like that?
I don't think so, no. And so this was a study done, or research that's been conducted up at Griffith University.
Yeah.
And so the conversation point that we were having around that was, it's potentially like an option for youth development programs for progressing or enhancing performance. If a sprinter, say, has more type 2 muscle fibers, is it worth having the conversation with them that maybe they shouldn't be doing sprinting? Maybe they should move more towards like 800 meter runs or 1500 meter runs. That's but then tough. Also, there's outliers in that. And if they really enjoy that sport, then should you be deterring them in a different direction? Or could that just be a way to help coaches sort of guide their training and what they should be doing in the gym? For example, if it is a sprinter and they've got more type 2 muscle fibers, then maybe they should be doing more things that are going to encourage like type 1 activity, like more heavy lifting and explosive work to try and drive that. But yeah, I thought that was quite interesting.
It is really interesting. Yeah. Is, I know there's been some research showing that you can change from one or the other, albeit only a small amount. I've heard that between they've looked at distance runners early on in their career and followed them over a longer period of time and looked at percentage of muscle fiber for between type 1 and type 2. And there was a percentage change, but I just remember the highest being quite small. When you look at those two different fiber types, is there a correlation between... I know it's logical, but I'm just asking, is there a correlation between performance or injury? So if you're a sprinter and you've got a higher percentage of type 1, does that mean you perform better if you were to say you've got the exact same person with a higher percentage type 2, or you're more likely to get injured?
No, I think it's more from like a performance perspective. Like you're genetically more inclined to be better at sprinting, say, than endurance events.
Yeah.
However, of course, there's other things that influence your ability to develop as an athlete.
Yeah.
But then like if someone's in a youth development program and they've like got strong goals to make it to the Olympics and they're tossing between, say, like 400 meters or 800 meters and they've got more type 2 muscle fibers, then maybe you could be like, maybe you should go a little bit more down the 800 meter route type
that's,
of thing.
That's really difficult because it's looking at someone's genetics. I mean, you could say the same thing with VO2. With someone with a high VO2, if you test them early on, which I know they're doing over in Norway, should those people then look at sports that are shorter duration or that have a high VO2? Because obviously there's lots of other factors that influence what you enjoy. That's interesting.
It is interesting.
It makes me think of the... when it comes to tendons and bones, and I had an awesome chat with Darcy Dore last week. That's the other thing about the podcast, being able to connect with awesome people. And spoke with him for an hour on Zoom just about plantar heel pain, which was cool, and just talking about structure and what that means for performance and education and injury. And I wonder if we can look at tendons and bones and look at their structure, potentially not so much early on, but later in life, and be able to potentially predict injury or have a higher probability of predicting when someone is going to get injured purely based off the structure, because we know structure does matter to some degree. We just don't know how to say that it matters. What do you think?
Well, I remember listening to a podcast. I don't know if it was one of Brad Beer's ones like ages ago. And I think his question was something along the lines of like, how close are we to being able to prevent injuries? And the person that they were interviewing was saying, well, essentially what we need is like a portable MRI machine that you can get instant MRIs of different bones and just assess whether there's any bony edema that's developing. But then now we know that that's kind of a normal response to load, and you're probably going to see that after a hard endurance run anyways. So I don't know if that's actually, like, I wonder if that person would say the same thing, knowing what we know now.
Yeah, but it's abnormal. Sorry, it's normal until it's not.
Yeah.
So I wonder.
But you don't know until it's symptomatic.
You don't, but so there has to be. I do believe there has to be something there, I think. I just think that we don't know what it is, because there's obviously some pathological continuum that happens, as we know. Degenerative tendon changes to the cellular matrix, all that kind of stuff is normal than a tendon, and it doesn't mean you're doomed to have tendinopathy. But as Keith was saying, you know, potentially Dr. Keith Marr, one of our episodes, I think it was 5 episodes ago, as he was saying, potentially if someone had a degenerative portion of their tendon, could that down the line further increase their risk of injury because that part's not as tolerable and that might do something to their tendon compared to if they didn't? And I wonder if we can be able to maybe screen with imaging. And I think in my world of condition, I see a lot of is the plantar fasciitis, plantar fasciopathy, plantar heel pain. And there's been good research to show if you have a plantar fascia that's 6 mil thickened or more, it has an association with plantar fasciopathy. Now, of course, the first thing you think, well, is it just they had plantar fasciopathy first and now they have a thickened plantar fascia or vice versa, kind of chicken or the egg. But does that thickened fascia then increase their risk of injury again, and there's something about the structure that is the reason for that?
I don't know, because I feel like we've tended to move away from imaging as being prognostic or even diagnostic in some parts of the body. So I don't know how that could, I don't know, maybe, but I can't really see that with what we know now, right now.
So the other portion to that, and this one I was speaking to Darcy about it, and he's been really spending a lot of time learning and putting a lot of effort into this, is looking at the plantar pad and just seeing how well it can absorb force. So when you put the plantar fat pad under stress, what happens to it, and comparing that between a pathological and a non-pathological side and just seeing the difference. So if,
what is the plantar pad? Is that just like a fat pad?
Yeah, plantar fat pad. So to think of it simply, you've got these little, what are they called? Little macrophages. So basically, to think of the fat pad, you've got these small cellular walls and then these bigger cellular walls, and they are really just like your external cushion. So how well they're able to basically dissipate force when you hit the ground, because when you're sitting there with your heel, you have a high amount of force underneath the heel from the ground reaction plus your body coming down. So how well it is able to dissipate force will theoretically reduce the force to the structures underneath, which is the origin of the plantar fascia plus other things. So if you have a plantar fat pad that isn't able to do that as well, potentially the forces are going to be higher in the pad and forces are going to be higher to those structures. So one of the reasons why, you know, heel lift and soft insoles and soft shoes can help is because you have external support. So structurally, if you could identify something from that plantar pad that tells us that it's not able to absorb force, and that could be as simple as you stand on it and you just get an image of how thick it is, does that mean that there's going to be less force underneath? And that really got me thinking, and this is Darcy's thinking, really smart, knowledgeable guy, and just got me thinking. Yeah, so that's another structural one, because that could mean then if someone's like a runner or they spend a lot of time on their feet and that pad just doesn't absorb the force,
maybe they should be in softer shoes.
Well, yeah, potentially that person might need a soft inner sole forever, or they might need a heel lift or a soft shoe, or they just need education. Well, it's not going to adapt, I don't think, as much as, say, like a tendon or a muscle, because it's involuntary in a sense. That there's certain structural parameters around that tissue that I think reduce the ceiling on the adaption front.
Okay.
But still interesting to think about. And that could be one of the reasons why plantar heel pain takes a long time. And one of the reasons why a lot of the research says we don't really know what works best. Lots of things work, but that gets up for everything. Wanted to ask you about this case. So someone sent in a question to the Instagram about an injury to a foot, quite a unique injury. Someone had a trauma to the foot, they dropped something, and this was the imaging result: low grade stress response to the plantar lateral navicular plus stress response to the cuneiform plus a small subchondral stress fracture to the second TMT line. So,
are they a runner?
No. So, force acting upon the foot. So, an acute overload. What do you think? What would be the management of that? What are you thinking straight away? So, this comes in the clinic, you get some imaging. What do you do?
I'd send that to a sports doc, honestly. Like, I wouldn't know what to do, if I'm being honest.
Well, if
that's weird enough for me. Oh, I'd offload them. I'd give them crutches or a boot and say, don't wait there.
Yeah. So we break it down. What's the highest risk area in that?
Navicular.
Yeah, navicular. Even though it's a low grade one, still a navicular, poor healing, lateral plantar surface. Cuneiform, not too bad because the loads aren't as high, but the TMT loads are going to be high as you move from mid stance to propulsion. So initial management on the day, what would it be? Obviously, saying sports doctor, but what would be the initial management?
Offload, like put them into a boot with crutches and say non-weight bearing until we have more guidance from the sports doctor.
Yeah.
Is pretty much all I'd do, really.
Yeah.
Give them some other like options in terms of exercise, things that they can still do, swimming, upper body work in the gym, maybe bike, possibly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And is the reason you're saying that is because with a navicular, the research would suggest the healing times are really quite long, and the percentage of people that have these injuries that end up with surgery is actually a lot higher than anywhere else in the foot and the ankle.
Yeah, it's just a bit of a weird diagnosis as well, like not something that I would have seen before to that sort of extent, like not a stress response in all of those areas, especially after an acute trauma, I would say.
Yeah.
So it's just not something that I feel particularly comfortable with, and I'm happy to just offload that. Yeah.
I think one of the values of that is you just don't know, whether it be sports doctor or even foot and ankle orthopedic surgeon.
Yeah, that's the other one. Yeah. For sure.
Yep. You don't know what you don't know. I mean, they could look at that and, you know, this depending on if you're going off the report or the imaging, but you could look at that and go, yeah, that's fine, non-weight bearing. And you might not even know, it might need a CT or it might need another x-ray from another view. And that's where, you know, foot and ankle ortho or sports doc come into consideration.
If I had the image before the consult, I'd probably call either the sports doctor or our foot and ankle ortho and have a chat to them about what they think and see what their thoughts are just initially, because they might be like, nah, that's fine, just pop them in a boot for a few weeks and off they go. Or they might say, oh, that's a bit weird, like, yeah, I'd like to see them. So that's probably what I would do.
I agree, and I think going a bit more aggressive with the non-weight bearing crutches and boot, what is the risk if then a week later they come off the crutches?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it's like, you've just had a week off, you're not going to have that much deconditioning compared to like, oh shit, you probably should have been these a bit earlier. Now we have to almost, you know, start back a week before.
Yeah, very good.
And I just wanted to add to that, understanding the risk factors. I mean, this is in a 65-year-old woman with osteopenia, doesn't spend much time on their feet. That's different to a 23-year-old triathlete, you know, who has an event coming up, or a 40-year-old trader that spends a lot of time on their feet. You know, the context does matter.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, what point you got here?
So this is just really interesting. It's probably not so relevant clinically for me or for us, I wouldn't say, but I just found this so fascinating. So the Olympics are coming up in July, August time periods, 6 months roughly. And
July, I think later than that, isn't it?
I think maybe the end of July is when they start, but don't quote me on it.
Cool.
So the surfing is, so Paris is where the Olympics are being held. We all know this. The surfing event has actually been moved to Tahiti. There's a particular surf break in Tahiti that they have selected for the surfing competition. Can't remember exactly what the name is, but this surf break in Tahiti has been banned for women since 2006 because it's really dangerous. There's been deaths, there's been some really serious injuries. So in 2006, they just decided to say women can't surf this break.
And why was that?
The reason being is because women can't paddle fast enough to get onto the wave safely. But 3 years ago, when they announced that this is a site for the surfing for the Olympics, they've opened up this surf break for women to start practicing, which is just so bizarre, isn't it? Like, this surf break hasn't been accessible for women ever, well, since 2006, and then in the last 3 years they've just suddenly made it available. And so women are having to learn all these new surfing techniques, really revise their paddling skill and learn that. So Griffith University, again, they've been doing all of these studies to try and increase their sprint paddling speed so that women can get onto the wave safely, which is just really fascinating what they've been doing. And it'll be, they pretty much don't really know what the result is until the Olympics come around, so it'll be fascinating to watch. I'm really excited to watch that sport, like I was anyways, but now knowing the context to it, I think is just really, really cool. But it's also just weird, hey, like if the Paris Olympics, you know, in France, obviously, like why aren't they just choosing a different break? Like why have they decided to go all the way to Tahiti when there's been this wave that hasn't even been available for women to practice on in such a long time? I just find that so crazy.
Yeah, I agree. I've got no idea. I mean, it's such a short period of time for them to go from not being able to do it to being able to do it. And I guess the only way to truly know is to go out and practice. Can I imagine they'd have the theoretical data of what they need to do? Like you have to hit this degree of power output to be able to paddle out onto the wave, but that isn't always the same in practice. So you'd have to go out and paddle on the the wave. And what if someone dies or injured?
Surfing, like it's not really a sport where you well, I don't think you refine your paddling technique when you're young. Like, you know how swimming, you get really like nitty gritty into your technique and things like that.
Mm.
I feel like surfing's not a sport where someone's like filming you and saying, no, you need to have this hand entry and pull like this and those sorts of things. So, I mean, I could just be guessing, but
yeah, I don't know. I don't really know.
I feel like surfing's quite a, like a family culture based sport almost. Like you grow, if you, your mum and dad did it, then you did it. Or if your friends did it and you lived on the coast, then you did it and you just kind of jumped in and learned. So it's just interesting that there's probably like, there's no data on effective surfing technique or paddling technique on a surfboard. And so they're just having to do all of this extra study now to get these women safely surfing in Tahiti.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I don't really know much about surfing. I just don't see that many. The ones that I almost all, it's always sesamoids. That's what I'm seeing in every single surfer. And you can't do anything because they're on the board barefoot. They're not going to wear their Hoka Bondis with a cutout deflection when they're on the board.
Yeah.
But obviously you can offload it outside of that. But
I see quite a few surfers, but it's more the recreational type. And
shoulders, surely.
Shoulders, yeah, would be the common one. Although backs or necks is the other.
I would not be good. My back and my neck, I'd be postured
stiff,
out.
You'd be stiff.
Mm.
Yeah, so that's just a really interesting point that I learned.
Yeah, that is interesting.
It was cool at the Congress, though, just to be having these conversations about all different types of sports. I mean, we're so buried deep in running and endurance sports, so it was really cool to learn about some of those different sports that aren't so commonly talked about.
Yeah. 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 I was thinking, I'm going to tell you a story.
About
another podcast I listen to that I really, really enjoy. That's the Inside Running podcast. I love to listen to them each week and hear the guys and girls talk about running, which is cool. But a couple of episodes I've been listening to, it's almost like what I imagine every runner to speak about their injury like, in a sense of not making all the mistakes that a runner would, but when I hear them speaking about it, it sounds so logical. So one of the guys on there is just struggling with a hip injury, and they were just speaking about the management, and they're not health professionals, but they've got a pretty good idea. They've been running for a while, and speaking about a hip injury and a lot of the discussion. So basically pain was stable, around a 1 or 2 out of 10, worse with faster activity, and they would just say, you know, you just need to take some time off, just take 2 weeks off completely and then start back up running again, or potentially look at getting a cortisone injection for it. And no one had kind of mentioned the diagnosis, potentially a bursa. It sounded like a glute tendinopathy, but just knowing to jump, like obviously jumping straight to cortisone is a, you know, something you don't want to do, especially if it's a tendon. But even if it's a bursa and it's been going on for 3 weeks, you know, cortisone probably isn't ideal on the timeline of what would be recommended for lateral hip pain. But one question that I thought would be awesome for us to talk about is, because we know that there's runners that listen to this that aren't health professionals, is basically when is it safe to continue running, and why is it important to continue running when you have an injury? Now, this question falls on the assumption that the person that you're seeing, or if you are listening to this, you are someone that running means a lot to you and it's very important. So if you're just doing it to, you know, for, you know, fitness or for health or for mental, you know, benefit, and you can easily switch out to something else, well, I guess, you know, that's fine. You can cross train and change. But for someone that really wants to continue running, what do you think? So when is it safe to continue running, and when is it not safe, and when should you stop?
Well, I think it needs to be assessed
first,
because you don't really know what you're dealing with until it's been assessed. Yeah. And let's say we've ruled out bone stress injuries and we are dealing with something like a tendon or a like a greater trochanteric bursitis.
Yeah.
Commonly they do go hand in hand anyway, so you do often get overlap with the two, and now that condition is often called greater trochanteric pain syndrome because you can't really differentiate between the two.
It's
that's not a particular problem that I think needs to be completely pain-free, and I would be almost encouraging someone, if they only had symptoms of a 1 out of 10, to be continuing to train through it to avoid a boom and bust cycle that would come from a a period of complete deloading. Like, a week off isn't going to cause that to happen. And sometimes we need to have, you know, a full week off just to let the body repair if we're feeling quite tired or fatigued. But if the reason that we're having the week off is to minimize pain, that's a 1 out of 10. I don't think you're going to be very successful with that particular condition a lot of the time. It's one that probably needs to get comfortable with the loading that you're doing. And yes, it's there for a reason. So it's your body saying that you need to dial things back, but I don't know that it's a reason to stop completely.
Yeah. And it sounds so logical, like stop, let it settle down and then start back up again. It's back to normal. But I guess the way I have people think about it when I'm seeing them in the clinic is, you know, finding currently what is the ceiling and the floor, like what is the threshold that this particular injury can tolerate. And if you're currently running and training and the pain is very stable and it's not fluctuating very much, you know, you're probably right at that ceiling if it's a 1 or a 2 out of 10. And if we think about the particular injury, we can usually, first line therapy is just trail. We can play around with your running, whether it be the intensity, the volume, the frequency, lots and lots of things. And in most cases, get on top of it. Yeah. So for someone with lateral hip pain, and I say this quite a lot with Achilles tendinopathy, if we're thinking them very similar, where they're probably not going to like faster running. So even if you look at just modifying the intensity, and you can do that so many different ways from Sunday, you can take it all out. You can just spread it out between 3 times a week. You could halve it by 50%, or you could take it out completely and you could reduce the volume. You can reduce, increase the frequency. Yeah. So,
and how often do you see this exact example of people that have come in months down the track where they had a little bit of pain initially and then they stopped running completely for 2 or 3 weeks and it started to feel better, great, started running again, and it's there straight away. So this isn't, I would suggest that, well, the people that I see, and I guess that's a bias because I probably don't see the people that gets better. So there would be people that have time off, and then they start running again and they feel better, but they don't come and see me. So I guess that I'm biased in that way. But it's common to hear that they've had time off and they start again and it's sore as soon as they start doing something again. And I think it's because they haven't exposed that structure or that tendon or that bursa to the loading at an appropriate level for it to adapt positively and for it to desensitize to that particular stimulus.
Yeah. And even when you're training with pain, you're still getting an adaption. Like your threshold for tolerance, if you can run 50 kilometers a week with a 1 out of 10 Achilles pain and you continue to do that and it's not getting any worse, your Achilles tendon is obviously tolerating that because we know that pain can be the result of many things. So if that is the case, you can pretty easily change some things. You certainly can have some time off, but the reason that we generally get people not to is because over that period, you can have some form of deconditioning. It's very likely that when you start back up again, if it's not guided by someone, you just ramp up and then it flares up again, or it ends up being worse than before. If you are having some time off, just focusing on doing some good, whether it be bone or tendon or general running related specific movements in that time off to keep some load on that structure and then building back in. One of the other things was just listening to the weekly recap of like doing a really hard speed session on one of the days and then the next morning getting up and going for a run. So a good example where intensity is very likely to irritate most lower limb running injuries, whether it be tendons or even compressive injuries, and then not giving it more than 24 hours or 48 hours rest is just going to build on that area not already being recovered. So I think with that you can almost, and I wonder if education on that, if you were to get 1,000 runners together, that would be a good idea for a study, 1,000 runners together and just run through a brief 20-minute education piece on that, how would injury incidents change? Do you think it would change much? If you were to just give the basics of that.
Injury incidents would change, but maybe
I've used the wrong word.
To run through them, I suppose, or to load manage more effectively or be able to self-manage their niggles maybe.
I'm big. Are you when you're in the clinic, are you really putting in a lot of effort into the education? Because
I think I do too much.
Yeah.
Sometimes I've been trying to dial it back a little bit and almost spread it out over sessions lately.
Yeah, I need to
because I think I'm. I have my bias is to give too much, and I probably get too. It's probably too overwhelming.
Yeah, that is what I was speaking about, because you always get your notes done, and I do not. Mm. And I really enjoy that connection and that relationship you build with someone, where in the last 5 minutes, I probably could, and I maybe need to get better at that, is just turn and kind of do my notes at the same time. But I just love, and maybe to my own detriment, I really love sitting there and explaining, and I'm drawing stuff and they're taking pictures and I'm telling them why I'm doing it. Like for a runner, as an example, I said to someone that the other day that, and they were wanting to hear that information. I think, you know, the risk of having this Achilles tendinopathy, again, is a little bit higher. And you have a couple of risk factors, which we know from the research would suggest that that is the case. So what we want to try and do is work on you having such a great understanding, in case things do flare up again or something else happens, you're able to self-manage better. And if not, you know, you can always come back to...
You can still do that in a 25-minute time slot. I mean, you don't have to, like, that doesn't have to go over, you know, to 35 minutes. You can just
not running
multiple sessions. And the other part of it is you see people less frequently than I do. So I've got, I have the opportunity to have these conversations on different consults, opposed to, you know, sometimes you're seeing people 6 weeks apart when you're doing reviews and things.
I would say the same as you, a week or 2 weeks.
Well, I think you just need to get better at your time management then.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying I'm running late. I mean just purely for notes.
Yeah, no.
So if I've got a 30-minute gap, what I'm saying is if I'm sitting there...
It takes 1 minute to write your notes.
If you're sitting there, all my attention is on you.
I'm not writing notes at the time anyways. Mm. We've talked about this on the podcast.
Yeah.
I don't do any notes while I'm when I'm talking with a person. Unless it's just to write down their quad strength was or what their training schedule is. Mm. Things like that. Or the year that they had their fusion or whatever it was. Like they're not the things that I will remember the specifics.
Yeah. At the very end, which I do need to. And sometimes I'll jot a couple of things down.
I'll send them off.
Early?
Maybe a couple minutes, 2 minutes early, seconds. And then I'll write my notes quickly and then bring the next person in.
Maybe it's that bit. I struggle going from them walking out, I might have a minute to spare, and then going straight into writing.
In any scenario.
Whoa!
Any time we go to leave any kind of event, it takes way longer than it should, because then you'll just like spark up this new conversation with someone when we're about to leave, and I think you just need to wrap it up,
it's what gives me, it really is what gives me energy. And I have this conversation with Justin, him and I are very similar, where just like we, you know how some people, and he was the first person to make me aware of this, some people walk away, and this isn't rightly or wrongly, some people walk away from a conversation where it drains their energy. They feel very deflated. Not the sense of they've had a bad conversation. They just feel like, oh, that took a lot. Whereas I feel as though, and so does Justin, I walk away from something and I'm like, holy shit, that was freaking awesome. I just talked to that guy about this or that, or we just did this podcast and I'm like, we'll finish this and I'll be excited. Like I love to have that dialogue, that speaking, because I think I truly believe that this format of speaking is the only way forward in anything that we want to be good at. Like, I believe that you can think of things yourself, but speaking with people out loud, the right people.
Which is why I was so keen to rehash the things that I learned from the Congress, because I feel like that's just such a good way for me to remember the things that I'd learned. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you want to go for a point, because we just talked about pain, and we talked about case study.
I've only got two more to go.
Whoa, two more, then dinner time.
Yeah, then dinner time. Okay. Yeah, sorry. This one's going
to
be a bit of a
long one. I don't want to cut you off. I just wanted to give a shout out to Jimmy Reid from Port Mac, greatest half marathon runner in Australia. And
good job, Jimmy.
And Zach from Next Gen Physio in Newcastle. I know they listen. I know there's plenty of people that listen, but I'm chatting
to them. Big shout
out. Yeah.
I want to give a shout out to Professor Sophia Nymphius.
Oh, who
probably butchered her last name.
No, that's how you pronounce it. Prof. Soph.
She is the coolest person in the world, honestly. Actually, second coolest, Madison Di Rosario, who is a para athlete of the marathon. She is the coolest person in the world.
Where's Taylor Swift on that?
So she's, well...
Who would you rather meet, her or Taylor Swift?
Probably Taylor.
Yeah.
But from a learning point of view and clinical side of things, these two women...
I reckon Taylor knows a way around a bone stress injury.
So Sophia was one of the keynote speakers, and she was amazing. So the main point that she was sort of driving is that there is a difference between sex and gender. So what women often, I guess, not get blamed, but are criticized for not being as athletic and not adapting as quickly and not recovering as well and not being as strong and as fast as men. She was sort of arguing that a lot of those issues are more gender-based problems rather than sex differences. Do you understand what the differences to that would be?
I guess so sex would be biological, gender would be social construct and social norms.
Yeah, exactly. So she was... So, for example, one of the studies that she referenced, which I thought was just really cool, and it's quite funny about how this study got approved through ethics, there was babies that were... perched onto a platform, and there was a slope that they were encouraged to crawl down, and the degree of the slope was gradually increased, and so they were monitoring between males and females, so comparing between the girls and the boy babies, which at which degree would they stop crawling down the slope because they perceived it to be too dangerous. And at the same time, or not the same time, prior, they asked their mothers how... what degree do you think that the babies will stop at? And so all of the mothers that had girls underestimated how steep the slope would be. And then all the mothers that had boys overestimated how steep the slope would be. And none of them were accurate, but it's just an interesting perception that starts from a very early age and with our parents' guidance and input and influence and things like that. I think that's really fascinating.
It is.
But she was saying that so differences being like training history, our environment, the context, training age, all of those sorts of things that are influencing our ability to excel in our particular sport. So one of the really fascinating things is that a lot of the youth development programs for a particular sport begins at 13 years of age. Now it probably needs to be beginning pre-puberty, which that is for boys, but not for women at all. So it would need to be beginning around the age of like 10 or maybe even 8 for women or girls to be considered pre-puberty. And the reason for that is because there's such a high dropout rate of sport in women, and that's because our bodies change, we start to get our periods, body hair starts to develop, self-consciousness, social pressures, all of those sorts of things.
Your frontal lobe develops earlier in females.
Yeah, so and the habit formation is another part of it. But then if the youth development programs aren't starting until 13 years for women, that's almost too late. And so then what happens is their overall volume of training across that time period between 13 to 18 is a lot less than males. So they're not getting as much of a stimulus and developing as robust of a training history as males. And then when they reach 18 years old, there's a really steep increase to get up to the level, like the standard of play that they're being exposed to. And so that's why the risk of injuries is probably a lot higher, particularly in ACL injuries is the really common thing or the very talked about thing at the moment in women. But that's what I was talking to Beau about recently. We were talking about the possibility of that in bone stress injuries maybe as well. And then on that note as well, so another really interesting fact which ties into that is, so one of the risk factors for ACL injuries is having a higher posterior tibial slope. That's a biomechanical risk factor that might predispose someone to developing a bone stress injury. ACL rupture. So, but then there's studies that looks at rats. It's in rats, disclosure. And there was a group of rats that did... bike riding or cycling or running on a wheel or something like that that had resistance. And then there was a group of rats that did it without resistance. And the groups that did it with resistance or and that had a higher sort of stimulus to their bones and to their ligaments, that posterior slope decreased. So it actually became flatter opposed to the rats that didn't. So how much translation that has to humans, not sure. But it almost implies that maybe if women had a an adequate training volume from the appropriate pre-puberty age at the volume equal to men and at the intensity equal to men, then maybe things would be different in the way of ACL injuries in particular, which is considered an epidemic at the moment. But it's probably, it should have been, like, you should see it coming, like the rise in women's sport and then the circumstances that women have had, it's not particularly surprising.
Going back to what we've spoken about before, pushing for this to grow and to move more, I mean, if we talk about the progression and the rate at which it's moving, if you look at it from both ends, I mean, one can't change without the other, it seems. So at a youth level, that needs to change, but that won't come to fruition for a really long time until they're, let's say theoretically, that's the sole thing you're looking at. Youth development and having exposure to lots of different stimuluses all the way up until the 20s and 25s and 30 age bracket when they're playing in a professional level. So whatever we implement now, we won't truly know until it's that stage anyway, because if we're talking about tissues, they take a long time to adapt.
Well, yeah, I guess what you... So it needs to be... So the 8-year-olds, the little 8-year-olds now need to go into their youth development programs, and then we need to monitor those 8-year-olds in, I don't know,
which takes a long time.
And see, or 20 years, and see if it's changed anything in the way of injuries. And and look, there's other things that influence it, like the standard of play has increased drastically in AFL, like the rules have changed even. So there's a lot of other things that come into play, but I think, you know, trying to develop their athletes well is probably a very pivotal part.
Well, the basis of this for evolution, that's why I enjoy reading books about evolution and these kind of philosophical thinkers, like the selfish gene from like Richard Dawkins, talking about nature versus nurture for every biological tissue that there is. And I guess the nature part is looking at the genetics of females and seeing how that differs. And that's what you're talking about, you know, changes in the body are vastly different from males through, you know, puberty, but also 30, 40, you know, pre and post menopause, versus the nurture, which is the environment that they're in. It's very, very hard to be able to single out one person and look at all those factors and see as a percentage, you know, if some people are potentially nurtures playing a bigger role than nature. But I think it is a step in the right direction. Even if we find that there's no difference, at least we know that there is no difference, or it's not something to focus on. It needs to happen, because as you said, and as we all know, the research percentage of females included is quite low, but it's only going to improve. I just don't know how quick it needs to happen, because there's barriers to that happening so quickly, and there's also harmful things of it happening so quickly.
Well, I think we've got a really good basis to grow off. I mean, there's hundreds of years worth of research that's been conducted on men, so we can almost fast track a lot of the research, because we can see what hasn't been effective that's been carried out in studies on males in the realm of performance anyways. And so maybe we can get some results or answers a bit quicker.
Yeah. It's funny when you were speaking about that just before, the amount of, I see a lot of severs, lots and lots of severs, tractional apophysitis of the calc. When I think back to the cases, if I think back to the last 10 cases, I think they all would have been males. They're all young boys. I really cannot think, I've definitely seen cases with females, but it is really boys that I have seen. I can't think seeing too many young girls with severs cases, which is just a thought that come into my head.
What's your hypothetical?
I don't know what the hypothetical is. It just usually, and I remember doing, I did a presentation for the Foot and Ankle Show over in the UK, like a webinar, and I remember reading a study, and I'd have to find it, that they'd showed there was no association with being more active, because the idea is if you use your heel more, whether it be from compressive load underneath or tractional pull on the Achilles and the growth plate, if you do that more, potentially your risk of severs is going to be higher. But I remember reading a study and they looked at a bunch of kids and there was no association with activity levels and servers, but logically it doesn't make too much sense. But anyway, you got any more points
there? Yeah, I've got one last thing to say, and it won't be for very long, but I think it's just an interesting point. So Kirsty Elliott-Sale, she's a professor from Manchester University, another one of the keynote speakers who was incredible, and learn a lot from her.
Mm.
She was talking about, so her main area is on the like ovarian hormones.
Yeah.
And she was just talking about how the menstrual cycle is quite a hype at the moment.
It is.
And it's a pet peeve of hers because she was just saying that it's only one component of the ovarian hormone profile that also encompasses a lot of other things. So 50% of athletes are taking some sort of hormonal contraception,
yep.
and 50% of athletes are not taking any contraception. So that would be the people that female. Are female. Yep. Yeah. That would be the people that are getting a menstrual cycle. So there's a big hype about only 50% of athletes, women, female athletes, really. And then there's, the contraceptive users, there's people that are going through menopause, there's people that are perimenopause, then there's people that have not got a period at all. There's other things that you can be talking about in the way of, like, their overall, like, well-being and other symptoms and signs and levels, like, signs of health as a female. And yeah, I just thought that was a really interesting point. Like, why are we so concerned about the menstrual cycle, and why are we neglecting to cover all of these other facets that make up a woman?
I think that the idea of the menstrual cycle and understanding what happens on a cellular level and a physiological level, it makes me think. So if I'm a male, which I am a male, I think, if I'm from the outside and I'm looking at, and I know this purely from conversations with you, and I find things like menopause, and I find things about the menstrual cycle very interesting just because it's the human body and I find that interesting. If I was looking at that and I see all these changes that are happening and we know how much of an influence that has on the body, to me, that seems like, well, it's only logical that we should be able to, or we should have some change around our training, or potentially there will be something that comes from the research. That's what I see and think, but obviously that doesn't seem to be the case.
Well, so she was saying that there's no high quality evidence to suggest phase-based training at the moment. It's
what about just phase-based life?
Well, that she was sort of saying the best thing that you can do is monitor your symptoms and pattern recognize. Mm. So for me, I know that I don't feel as great in the week leading up to my period. And then the day that I get it, I start to feel really, really good. And that's a pattern that I've recognized over the last 2 years of tracking my cycle. Wait, say that again.
You what? You...
What?
You've...
I feel good the day I get it. Why are you laughing?
I'm not. I just was thinking of this joke. One of the boys said the other day. It's really funny. Anyway.
What? Tell me.
Well, you and I are on... We're both on the Femi running app. I'm on the Femi running app is an app for females that give you a running plan and you have to log your cycle and stuff.
So I've synced us up.
Yeah, so I'm on the same one. So I'm in my... What are we in?
We're in our luteal phase.
We're in our luteal phase. So, yeah. I mean, that's...
I'm looking forward to the follicular. Yeah. But not because that's what I've been told. It's because what I've identified as being a point in my cycle that I feel better
which
at.
Which is the pattern recognition. Yeah. But the but app
so,
is... Sorry,
so, go. Well, I was just going to say, like... The concern is that people will read, oh, I should be feeling good in my follicular phase and bad in my luteal phase, and then they're going to be unnecessarily making changes when maybe they don't need to. So each woman is very individual in the symptoms that they might experience, so they might not have to adapt or change their training.
Yeah, I think the app is cool. I've been reading about it because it gives you a little spill about what's happening in your body. And I think the idea of being able to journal and say how you're feeling, and it might be as simple as you just doing an RPE at the end of the day or at the end of a training session and just seeing how that behaves at what place you are in your cycle. And I just think that's cool because then that gives you that pattern recognition.
Yeah.
I never thought I'd be speaking about the menstrual cycle on a podcast in all my years of practice, but here
and
we are.
You've been logging your symptoms too. Yeah. There you go.
Yeah. And it is interesting to see because I, and this is, I've read both of Stacey Sims' books. One is Raw, and the other one is On the Menstrual Cycle. And
Menopause.
Menopause, sorry, not the Menstrual Cycle, On Menopause. And the start of the book, you know, it just speaks to the public perception of what happens to a female's body. And if you read the book, like, they quote news articles, they quote statements being put out by, like, the American Medical Association, and it was really just thought of as, like, this is women's problems, just kind of deal with it on your own, and we don't really know, and, like, people are having symptoms, it's really affecting people's lives, and doctors and people that they're talking about, like, yeah, just kind of deal with it on your own, that's a woman's problem.
Hush.
And there's these real changes going on, and there's things that we can do about it, but a lot of the information and just the support wasn't there, and I don't know, it just doesn't, it has never sat right with me. Like, I speak to patients about menopause to a very low level, and I recommend that they go and speak to other people who I trust, and people are just so shocked when I speak about it. I'm like, yeah, that could potentially be, or these things can happen with your body, and that could be a potential contributor. This is who should go and speak about it. And I've got to say, it feels pretty amazing to have people say, I've never had someone tell me this, or I just feel like you've really listened to me. And I have the same experience when I see people with hypermobility or connective tissue disorders. And I'm like, yeah, some of these symptoms are normal for what is happening in your body. And this is why, and this is how we can potentially help. And it's not your fault or the fact that you haven't been compliant with your rehab. Yeah. And that's so rewarding. And that's purely from, and the podcast has played a huge role in that, but that's cool, just from seeking out that information.
I was wondering about this too, because even, you know, on Friday, I was like, wow, this is really becoming a lot less taboo. Like, we're talking about what it feels like when there's blood leaking out when we're on our period, when you're playing a sport. Like, and it was just so easy to have those conversations. And I was like, maybe that's just the circle that I'm in. Like, maybe it's not as openly discussed as it was in that room, for instance. But yeah, I wonder if sometimes we get a bit stuck in our bubbles, but I hope not. I hope it is becoming a bit less taboo and a bit more talked about.
I believe one of the main reasons is just a lack of understanding and knowledge. So if you're not, I mean, comfortable, yes, but if you don't understand what you're talking about, it's very hard to then give advice, and the confidence obviously shows. Like, I spoke to someone about leakage the other day that was doing some, we were managing it, so bilateral insertional Achilles, and we were, unilateral, one was a heel pain on the other side, unilateral, and we're just doing some double jumps, and we had spoken about some, this person was late 40s, and they told me they were seeing someone women's health, and they were going kind of through menopause. I was like, yeah, great, you know, I've, you know, got an all right understanding of that. These are some of the things that we may consider with your rehab, and this is, you know, may be what it means with your fatigue levels, or potentially it might not be this straight linear equation, and so forth. And they're doing some double jumping, like, oh, I don't know, sometimes I struggle with doing this. I was like, oh, is it pain? Is it function? And then talk about that leak. And I was like, oh, great, that's okay. I completely understand that. Told her that, you know, we've done a podcast with Caitlin Daly, and I've got an all right understanding of that, and this is what we're going to do to change that, and you need to follow that up with your physio. And it was so easy to speak about, because I was like, yeah, that's fine. Like, it happens. And I felt like they felt so comfortable even to say that. And
well, yeah, they would. Yeah. Actually, one of the conversations that we had on Friday was on that, and there was a consensus statement about navigating urinary incontinence. And I'll just say this quickly and then we'll wrap things up for today. But the consensus was that women are happy to have a conversation with anyone, male or female, as long as they are empathetic and they are confident in giving, you know, their appropriate level of advice and recommending the appropriate person that they should be discussing it in further lengths with. So, and that was overall majority of women had stated that. So it's good. Like, I think, it doesn't just need to be a woman that's having that conversation. And as long as you're going into that topic with empathy and you're understanding where you're coming from and why you're having the conversation, then a woman's going to really appreciate it.
Yeah. I mean, I have this conversation every day, multiple times a day, not about leakage and menstrual cycles and menopause, but speaking about footwear. So footwear plays a huge role to influence the internal external loads upon the foot, which in turn can help someone's pain and function. So I'm talking about shoes all the time with people. one of the barriers to people wanting to wear shoes is the look, understandably, and we both fit into that category. Trying to find a nice looking, comfortable, characteristic, appropriate shoe can sometimes be a struggle for both males and females. So I'm constantly telling people and having these conversations, like, I really understand what you mean where you don't want to wear this big ugly orthopedic shoe, and I certainly don't want you to wear that. So showing people that I do understand where they're coming from, I think I've got a little bit of, a bit more confidence because I speak about shoes all the time. And I'm like, hey, I wouldn't want to wear this ugly thing. Let's look at some shoes that you like. And I always say, please tell me from the start if you don't like it, because there's plenty out there.
Yeah.
And I really want you to understand that we're going to find the shoe, and I know that you want to look nice when you go out for lunch or go out for dinner, and you don't want to wear this big, ugly, soft jogger.
Mm.
So, yeah, that's one of the factors on there.
Well, thank you all for tuning in to episode 100.
Yeah.
Triple digits, we've made it.
This is it.
That was a really fun episode. I enjoyed recording that, so hopefully you all did too. So
yeah, and thank you, listeners. We really appreciate it. I mean, we've made plenty of connections. We've provided lots of, I'm going to say, good education and good advice, because a lot of you have stuck around, which is great. And we hope to continue to do this forever. Kelly and I were saying, hopefully when we're like 45 years old, we're going, who have we got this Saturday for the podcast? So we'll hopefully
welcome
still
to episode 3,749 of the Sports Medicine.
If we keep going, we'll speak to everyone, and then we'll just have to, and then we're like, great, we'll just start back again. Imagine speaking to like Rich Willie in 10 years or something like that. Like, the questions are going to be, everyone's like, so what is a bone stress injury? The next time it's going to be like, we've just spent 10 years.
How do we spice this up?
Yeah. Tell me on this molecular level, if this happens, then how does that consult? Awesome, guys. Thank you very much. We'll speak to you all in a couple of weeks. We'll be back with a guest, and it will be us again, return guest for episode 101. But we will have a very special guest again. Enjoy. Have a lovely week.